The social-cultural challenges faced by the older boomer generation was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 19, 2007, at the 2007 Oktoberfest entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Seth is going to give a handful of these handouts to each table. If you could pass them around, let's see, I'll keep one. So just give a handful to each table. Thank you, Seth. While he's passing that out, really, everything I have to say is going to be on this piece of paper, but let me just, and then I just want to go over it with you. But let me set the stage for what it is I am doing, what I'm trying to accomplish, and what I understand my assignment is. The real work is going to be done tomorrow as we hear the students talk and get their perspective and get their experience and then have a chance to interact with them. What we're doing tonight is sort of giving information that's going to provide the context for what it is that you're going to hear tomorrow. So I'm not really talking about anything that any of you who are older have not lived through and experienced. Maybe the only service I've done is to stand up here and remind you what it was that we experienced. You will notice I have tinged each stapled corner with the drug of my choice, just in honor of the 60s here. So I can't be exhaustive, I can't be complete, I don't pretend like this is just some fantastic sociological analysis of the 60s. I'm just giving you my perspective. And in some ways, I'm not sure how well suited I am to be the one giving you my perspective. I was a sort of Christian nerd who grew his hair long and became a Jesus freak. And that's my experience. I was very much on the outside of the essence of what was happening in the 60s. I was observing it. I was watching it. I was around it. But I certainly wasn't living it in the same way that many of the children of the 60s lived it. So I'm not speaking from the inside, really. I'm speaking as an outsider to all this. So many of you may have something very significant to contribute. And I hope you'll understand that the whole forum this weekend, not so much tonight, but tomorrow, is an open forum. So I hope that you will all contribute to our insight and our understanding of the history of why my generation has become what my generation is and why the younger generation is becoming what it is. I think many of you will have a lot to contribute to our understanding. And please, when you have the opportunity, give us your insight and give us your input. Everybody pretty much has a sheet now? Okay. Anyone not get one? Great, thank you. I've organized this. First of all, I want to talk about what the 60s, what I call the 60s revolution, what I think it was a reaction to, talk briefly about that, and then the rest of it, and then I want to talk about four or five things that I think are striking differences between the culture of that we grew up in, children of the 60s, and the culture that our children today are growing up in. Some really striking cultural differences. And then I end with a chart where my thesis is that the 60s generation, the revolution that took place in the 60s, created some seeds for change in the culture. In those seeds for change, some of what had been passed on to down to us was retained, but some of it was significantly and radically new. And so my first column will be the seeds of change with respect to the topic on the left. The middle column will be what is the residual of the tradition that was handed down to us that has been maintained. And then briefly, my observations on, as I watched down through the decades, what came of the change that our generation spawned, and just some observations about where I think it went, which is not to say that's where today's generation is. I'm not making that claim. I'm just saying, I mean, today's youth generation is. I'm just making the claim that these are the ways in which the revolution that we started, the outcome that seemed to have its impact down through time. So those are the three things I want to do. The first one, what in the post-war 50s was the youth revolution of the 60s a reaction to? The one thing I think it was a reaction to, and I felt this very acutely and personally, was the stifling conformism that came out of the 50s. And I don't know what the historical reasons were for such a strongly conformist culture. I just remember going to elementary school, and I wore the same shoes as all the other boys, and my hair was exactly the same length. We all had butch wax that, you know, my hair in front was stuck up with butch wax, and everybody looked pretty much the same. Didn't even think about it. I thought everybody looked the same because everybody was supposed to look the same. I mean, it just didn't even occur to me that there was any other way to be. So when the 60s hit and people started dressing funny and wearing their hair different and looking funny, I mean, when you look at the pictures now, I mean, who invented bell bottoms? And especially paisley bell bottoms. I mean, when you look back at it now, it looks really, really weird. But the young generation looks at those pictures and thinks, what were you thinking? Well, what they don't realize is what we were coming out of, what we were reacting to and what we were responding to. A stifling conformism. Also at the time, we who were younger during the late 50s and into the 60s were encountering a culture where there was what seemed to us rampant materialism. Consumerism that was what was full speed ahead. That after the war, when personal wealth and prosperity began to grow, and that prosperity went into becoming more and more consumers and more materialistic, it created a whole spirit to which the youth generation, the young people coming up, reacted. And that was part of what they were reacting to. Thirdly, and I don't understand this. I had no experience with this. This didn't make it really any sense to me. But looking back on the lives of the people around me, I think they were also reacting to what looked to them to be an incredible hypocrisy implicit in the traditional sexual ethic that existed in before them. They were taught one thing, but they saw people practicing another sexual ethic. And their solution to that, encouraged by Freud, who everybody was reading in the 50s, their reaction to that was to see those traditional values as unnecessarily repressive. The reason people are not practicing the sexual ethic is because it can't be practiced. That sexual ethic is just repressive. And we need to get rid of the sexual ethic altogether and feel the freedom to explore, experiment, and be the sexual beings that we are. And as I say, Freud contributed to that because he was widely read and gave them the lenses through which they were looking at their experience. And then finally, I think there was the hypocrisy and the lack of authenticity in cultural Christianity. That was a large part of the reaction was to what struck them as the phoniness and emptiness of the Christian cultures that they were coming out of. I think that's what it was a reaction to, and maybe some of you have some other ideas about what else it might be reacting to. Next, I'm going to look at a couple of sets of cultural realities, the cultural realities of the 60s as opposed to the cultural reality that our college-age students are in today. Take the academic environment. In the 60s, the traditional liberal arts education was still the core of education. When I was at Stanford, they had a committee to revamp the undergraduate education, and they made significant radical changes in that education. But my professors, everyone that influenced me, had come out of a long tradition of believing in liberal arts, and that was the core of every education. They believed that you went to school to get educated, that that's why you were there. Today, I would argue, and our generation is the one that started it, we've got to a point where academic environment today tends to be a sophisticated vocational training social engineering experiment. I mean, that's what's going on in the academy today. Education is not at all the same thing. The academic experience today is not the same thing that it was when I was in school. Now, you'll find professors for whom the traditional view is still alive and well, but it seems to me the institution, the structures, the culture, and everything else has been drastically changed over time, and that affects the students that go through. Second thing is technology. Today, I mean, I don't need to tell you. I mean, there's everything imaginable available to you in technology, just the most spectacular stuff going on. I remember this big box at the coffee house at the college. It was a Pong game. That was the height of our technology. A little ball bouncing from one side to the other, and you had a paddle to keep it from hitting the side. Really, really high tech, sophisticated. You know, now you have the video games, virtual reality, where you think you're living another life because it's such great graphics and stuff like that. Well, the kids of this day can't imagine how much they're being impacted by technology. We weren't impacted because it didn't exist. It just wasn't even around yet. Marriage and family, the cultural reality of the 60s, the divorce was relatively rare, I think, compared to today, at least coming up to the 60s. Divorce was relatively difficult and therefore more rare. And it was during the 60s that the real divorce revolution even began. The whole idea of legally having a no-fault divorce was born in the 60s. Today, divorce is much more common, much easier. Child abuse, relatively unheard of when I was a child. I didn't know any children that were experiencing child abuse. Parenting, it seemed to me, was relatively kind and nurturing in the lives of anybody that I knew growing up. In the lives of the students today, child abuse of one kind or another has been rampant, and the parenting that they have received is often very unkind and very non-nurturing. The college students that we interact with, when you look at their experiences, it really becomes a valid question to them. Does this marriage and family thing work? That wasn't really a question for me in my experience, and I don't think for a lot of my peers. So that's really changed. Hypocrisy, I remember having debates in college where the issue of hypocrisy, Christians being hypocrites, would come up, and the examples they would give was the Inquisition in the Middle Ages. Today, students always refer to the hypocrisy right on their doorstep. Their own families, their own experiences, their own friends, the things that were intimately connected with their lives, where they've seen firsthand, directly, saying one thing, advocating one set of values, and not seeing it lived out in their lives. I just think they have a whole different experience with the Christian faith than I have. Dialogue. In my experience, there are models of real dialogue at the university and in the academy. Genuine attempts at fair-minded objectivity still existed in the culture. I went to Stanford, and the professors in the philosophy department where I was at that time were absolutely incredible at being able to teach a different philosopher from inside that philosopher's perspective. And at the end of the course, I couldn't tell you what that philosopher believed. I had no idea what his own personal and real commitments were, because he was so able to charitably, objectively, fair-mindedly present each and every philosopher as we came along. I'm not sure I agree with that model of education, but when all is said and done, you couldn't fault them on their neutrality and their objectivity. They were very fair-minded toward other people's ideas. What do we find today? In social political dialogue, you have two people shouting at each other, shouting slogans at each other, talking over the top of each other. No one's listening to each other. You don't get an education. You don't get informed. You just get stressed out and anxious listening to them. That's what passes for dialogue to the younger generation coming up, because that's all they see. That's the only model that's ever been given to them. I think we had a different kind of model. Okay, quickly here, what were the seeds of change that were in the winds when we were in the 60s? With respect to knowledge, truth, morality, and the nature of reality, I think it was Jerry Rubin from the Yippies who said, don't trust anyone over 30. Our generation said, traditional ideas are used to control you, subjugate you, oppress you, and ensnare you. Those older people just want you to be a part of the establishment. Don't listen to them. But it was very selective. It's don't listen to them because their answers don't work. But we didn't have the idea, I don't think, that there was any problem with truth. I think we still, it would have resonated with us to say the truth will set you free. That would have still resonated with us. Yes, we want the truth. We just don't think the older generation has it. So we're going to go looking for truth, and we're not going to accept the answers that have been handed to us by the older generation. What was the eventual outcome of that? There is no valid knowledge of anything important. Truth is a joke. Truth is a tool that's used by those in power to stay in power. All ideas are attempts to control and snare you. There's nothing but that. That's all there is. That's where the seed we planted seems to have grown. With respect to intellectual pursuits, we had a mistrust of traditional vehicles for intellectual pursuits. But even though we mistrusted the traditional vehicles for intellectual pursuits, we didn't reject intellectual pursuit in itself. I had a number of conversations with Berkeley Street people who were intellectually curious and literate. They didn't go to college, but they were well-read, and they were very much working with ideas and believed in ideas. For some streams of our culture, the seed that we planted became the idea that there's no intrinsic positive value to literacy and intellectual pursuits at all. If it's not marketable, why bother? Why go there? Same with education. We did have the idea that you don't need to learn from people with traditional credentials. So there were all kinds of, every university back in the 60s had a counter university alongside of it, or what we called the free university, different names for it, where people with experience would come and teach classes even though they didn't have the traditional academic credentials. So we challenged whether you needed those traditional credentials. But we didn't challenge whether being educated is important. That was still very much alive and well among us. Where did those seeds go? In some corners, in some circles, being educated is not important. It's being equipped to make money is what's important. Drugs. As you know, drugs came on the scene, washed over us in the 60s. But for the most part, with some exceptions, but for the most part, it seemed to be part of a spiritual search. Drugs can lead to greater enlightenment regarding the nature of reality. At least the people who wrote about drugs and gave an intellectual defense of drugs, that was their claim. I knew some people who just used it recreationally and were just drug addicts, but I could tell the difference. You could tell the difference between the two different kinds. So we still had in mind that it made sense to be on a quest for greater enlightenment and that was a positive goal. That was still a part of our thinking. In time, however, the drugs just became a distraction. They just became a diversion. They just became recreational. And so pleasure, happiness, and keeping from boredom becomes the primary goal and the use of drugs for a lot of people over time. With respect to personal identity, our generation talked a lot about identity crises. There was a book that was widely read at the time called Young Man Luther, talking about Martin Luther's identity crisis, and that we all identified with that. That was... That's what we were all dealing with in our lives, was our own individual personal identity crisis. Why? Because we had rejected all traditional modes for establishing our identity. That wasn't going to work for us. And so it left us without an identity, or at least we needed to discover what it was. But we were seeking to discover what it was. We didn't reject that as a goal. Eventually, where that seems to go is that it's not that we're trying to discover who we are, we're actually in a position to try to create who we are. And I'm sure the students tomorrow will talk a little bit more about that. With respect to the meaning of existence, we mistrusted the traditional answers, but we believed that there was a meaning to existence to be found, that that was a meaningful concept. As time went on, that changed, and the seed of that change was that there is no meaning of existence at all, altogether. With respect to sexuality, we abandoned all cultural restraints on sexual expression. Free love was the phrase. The residual from the traditional foundations is, at least for the most part, hippies believed that sex is for and about love. For the most part, that was still maintained. It wasn't long until that changed, and that abandoning all the cultural restraints developed into sex being about sex, about physical pleasure, about recreation. It wasn't even about love. With respect to wealth and stuff, our generation, at least the hippies among us, rejected stuff as the way to meaning and happiness. And I knew a lot of people who were very serious about that. They seriously adapted their lifestyles to live in a manner consistent with their claiming that stuff was not where it's at. I spent time on one particular hippie commune where they lived hand-to-mouth existence for the most part. Well, as long as you had enough for paint and creativity and stuff like that as well. But there was deep hypocrisy, don't get me wrong. A lot of those people had capitalist parents back on the East Coast that would send the money periodically to make all that stuff possible. But for the most part, they were trying to take seriously that there was more to life than just stuff. And they were right about that, I think. But eventually there was a counter-reaction. And that in that counter-reaction, being a consumer is pretty much what it's all about. And there's a whole segment of our society that probably is there. With respect to social conformity, we talked about doing our own thing in the 60s. That upheld what I think is at least implicit in our traditional foundational values, that individuality is important. It at least maintained that truth. But as that develops further in the history of America, it becomes individual self-invention. Not self-discovery, as I talked about earlier, but actually self-invention. Our moral self-concept, some of the most self-righteous people I knew were some of the hippies that I knew. Much more insufferably self-righteous than any religious fundamentalist that I had ever encountered. They were just convinced that they were way more enlightened than any of the rest of us. So an insufferable sense of moral superiority. But at least that maintained the traditional value that it's important to have an uncompromised moral integrity in what I do and what I am. At least it was maintaining that. But the counter-reaction to that has become no one has moral integrity. Everybody is corrupt. Everybody is phony. No one is morally better than anyone else. Don't even make that moral judgment. We can't go there. With respect to social and political activism, we saw meaning through social and political action where we can make a difference in the world through social and political action. The emphasis there was on morality. We wanted to do good in the world. We wanted to make a change for what was more just and more loving. And it was connected with a quest for personal meaning through morality. A very good and noble thing. In time, however, as part of the self-created identity that we were seeking through social political action is no longer driven by morality, and it's no longer driven by a quest for discovering personal meaning, but it's just faddish. It's for the image potential that a social political action might have. And then finally, with respect to Christianity in our generation was identified with the establishment, and therefore it was rejected. Christianity was square to us. The truth in that is that it recognized the failings and the hypocrisy of cultural Christianity, I believe, but that rejection, as it worked out in our culture, has come for a lot of people to be that Christianity is anti-human, Christianity is just downright evil, and Christianity is the enemy. I think that's the world we grew up in.